Welcome into another edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. He is Dan. And Dan, for this 48th edition of the podcast, we are joined by the legend, Brian Snow.
How you guys doing? Anything going on in the world of college basketball?
I think we'll get to that here in a second.
Okay, I just didn't know.
That's sort of the point of the podcast. I mean, unless we're going to like review, I don't know, movies or something. Anyhow,
I haven't seen a movie in a long time, so it's probably a bad idea.
Anyhow, edition number 48, Rick, we're going to dial it back to my favorite Red season of all time, 1999, and Scott Williamson, the rookie closer at the time. Was he rookie of the year, Snow? I think he was.
I believe he was.
That's right. They had a great bullpen that year, the triple-headed monster of Williamson, Danny Graves, before he weighed 800 pounds and started throwing the ball 60 miles an hour, and Scotty Sullivan. So that was a fun team.
The Sidewinder.
All right. Since our last show, the Musketeers played in the NCAA tournament.
Briefly.
The less said about that, the better. That closed the books on the season. They with the 74-59 loss to NC State at UD Arena last Tuesday. Musketeers close out the season at 21-13. They lost four of their last five, and it was not a pretty finish. But we'll get to that a little bit more. What we're going to do actually is we're going to hit sort of our season in review show in a couple weeks, I think, probably after the NCAA tournament's over, because right now, obviously, there's news that everyone wants to talk about. Everyone wants to hear the two experts on the line with me weigh in on, and that's the Chris Mack situation, some of the potential transfer news, Samaje Christen, et cetera. So, fellas, let's get right into it. Rick, it is Wednesday night about 8 o'clock. What's your take on the Chris Mack / Wake Forest situation?
Well, I guess at this point, what we know is on Monday, it was made public that he had emerged as a candidate for the head coaching job at Wake Forest. Last night on Tuesday, it was confirmed that there had been mutual interest and contact between the two parties. At this point, based on all the conversations I've had over the last 48 plus hours, and I think Brian will, for the most part, back me up on this. I'll let him jump in after me and fill you in on what I missed. But I think there's legitimate interest from both parties. That much is clear. I think there's a chance that Chris Mack would take this job. I think that's still up in the air. But I think ultimately my gut instinct, you put a gun to my head, says he ends up back at Xavier, at least for now, with what he has coming back. But I think it's also worth noting that he's not the top candidate for the Wake job at this point. So if he gets a great offer, and I think Wake is in position to make him one, if he ends up being the guy that they want, then I think there is a chance that he could be convinced. Obviously, Wake has Ron Wellman, so things would have to be smoothed over there. The program is a bit of a mess, but I think, you know, you look at particularly Mitch Shaw, who is a member of Wake's Board of Trustees. He's the CEO of Atlanta's Noble Investment Group, and he's really good friends with Chris Mack from, you know, Chris's previous time spent out there. He's a guy that can dig into his own pockets and come up with a really good offer for Chris. So I think there are people there in place that would make him feel wanted, that would make him feel comfortable. I think with some of the issues Chris has had with Xavier's administration, there is a part of him that would be interested in looking elsewhere right now, even if it's not a definite move up, and even if there is some things he would have to overcome, which is kind of a bottom four job in the ACC right now in Wake Forest. So I'll let Snow jump in, but those are kind of my initial thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, what's been weird is, you know, I've done some asking, and everyone around Xavier right now has indicated the same thing, that it's just kind of business as usual and that no one's talking about anything. Now, this is not abnormal. You know, when Sean Miller left, when Brad Stevens was contemplating leaving for jobs, I would get calls from members of their staffs and be like, hey, what are you hearing? Because we don't have no idea. Like, legitimately, like, the way this stuff works is the head coach does it head coach and his wife probably have a clue. And if anyone else does, they're probably lying to you. So it's kind of been business as usual. One thing that I think needs to be said is we've had a lot of discussion on the message board about, you know, raising Chris's salary and all this stuff. And there's a million issues involved in that. Xavier's not doing that right now. And anyone that thinks they are is just incredibly wrong. They're not throwing the world at Chris to try to keep him. And despite what you might have read on the internet 4 years ago or 5 years ago, they didn't do that with Sean Miller either. It was, hey, I'm interested in Arizona. They said, here's what we can do. And you've basically already got it. So anyone that thinks they're just throwing money at these coaches to try to keep them is wrong. So let's get that out of the way. You know, in terms of what I think he's going to come back. I just think there's a lot of reason, a little bit more reason for him to come back than to leave. I think it's well known that, you know, Chris Mack and the administration and the basketball program in general aren't necessarily exchanging Christmas cards, but we have a thread on the message board, and I think it really gets to a lot of the issue right now in intercollegiate athletics, where you have presidents who are really feeling the push from their faculty and from the academic community to not cave to athletics. And that includes all the money, because the money is just huge at this point. Well, at the same time, you have the folks in the athletic department, whether that's a head coach or an athletic director or whoever it may be, saying, hey, listen, we make you this money. You leave us the heck alone and you do your job on the academic side and don't step in. So you now more than maybe ever, I think you just see this massive chasm between athletic departments and university presidents, and Xavier is no different. And if anyone thinks Ohio State's any different, you're out of your mind. If you think UC's any different, you're out of your mind. Now, they'll play nice in public, but the reality is there's so many issues right now in intercollegiate athletics that, you know, not everyone's friendly with each other, like maybe there was 25 years ago when the money was 1/20th of what it is now. The schools love the money that athletics bring them, and then they use creative accounting practices to make it seem like they're not making any. But at the same time, they don't necessarily love everything athletics stands for, where it can take over a university's identity, and where, you know, some of the kids that you take for athletic reasons wouldn't be kids that you would normally allow in school. And that has caused major, major issues. Not, and this is not a Xavier issue. This is an NCAA member school issue all across the country.
There definitely is a tension between academics and athletics, Brian. And as you talk about the money that's involved, it makes it so much more difficult. And I think somebody made the point, you know, yeah, the men's basketball program makes a great deal of money, and maybe earmarking $500,000 to maybe make Chris Mack, maybe make his assistants a little happier, seems like a logical step. But then again, you know, you're talking about a university that's just had a reduction in force on its academic staff last year and cut, you know, 10, 12, 13 jobs that may be roughly the same investment when you get down to it. So it's a definite question. Brian, Rick mentioned the Wake Forest job. Who do you see, who are you hearing as the top candidates for that job? And where do you think Chris stands on that list as of right now?
Right now, I think he's a little bit behind Greg Marshall and Shaka Smart. But I don't see either of them taking that job. So I think realistically, Chris is the number one candidate. And here's what people have to realize. Like, no one's offered a job until you know they're going to accept it. Like, if you get turned down in a coaching search, you're an idiot. It should never happen. You only offer the job to someone if you know they're going to take it. So while Chris may never get offered the job, or Shaka may never get offered the job, it's just a matter of that means that the guys already knew they weren't going to take it.
Yeah, I think that's going to be interesting, because you mentioned Greg Marshall and Shaka Smart both probably not being interested. I think Chris is interested enough that he's going to listen. And if they present him with an offer, I just don't know that like you said, Xavier is in any place to offer him more right now. I don't see him getting any type of significant raise. I mean, they may try to bump up something, but I think that's what makes this interesting. And then you have that's one wild card that kind of makes it say, maybe there's a chance. And then the other side of things that I think makes everything interesting is we just don't really know all that much about Greg Christopher and how he'll handle this. I mean, we kind of got used to how Mike Babinski handled things and what he would do. And we also kind of knew what the next step would be, that he would look in house. With Greg Christopher, I think he's a guy, you know, he looks at Xavier as probably a stepping stone AD job as well. He's on the move. He's on the rise. I'm sure he wants a bigger football job. So he probably looks as it is, you know, if there's issues between Chris and the administration, I'd love to make my own big hire and look good to future job candidates. And I think that makes things interesting as well. And then what his next step is would be really interesting, because some of the names that people are throwing around, like a Travis Steele who's already here, or a Pat Kelsey was here in the past, I don't know that he would want to look in that direction. He might want to make his own hire and not make what would seem like the Xavier hire. And with him having kind of a relatively small circle to this point in his professional career, I think it'd be really interesting to see what would happen in this situation.
Well, going back to something that Brian said, this has been my first, the first issue that I have when you look at this is, as of right now, XU, in terms of their compensation for their head coach and their assistant coaches, despite the fact their facilities are great, a lot of the perks that go along with the job are you know, pretty high level, maybe not Marquette level, but pretty high level. But their compensation is close to the bottom of the Big East. And it just seems to me that regardless of whether they want to retain Chris Mack or hire somebody that's going to be able to keep this program moving forward, a credible candidate, they're going to have to bump up that compensation package anyway. I mean, am I wrong, or am I oversimplifying things, or does that seem right to you guys?
Well, first of all, let's put it out there. Xavier, in terms of overall compensation, is certainly no higher than eighth in the Big East and probably solid ninth. Heck, I don't even think it was in the top half of the Atlantic 10. So I think people do need to realize that. Now, I'm not getting into the issues of can they afford it, can they not. That's for other people to know, not for me. But that's the reality as it currently stands. In terms of bumping it up, I don't think, you know, for a first year, once again, the Greg Christopher factor is a wild card. You know, he could go after Louis Orr for all I know and pay him $300,000 and call it a day and look great telling Father Graham he saved $600,000 or whatever it is. I don't know. But, you know, I don't think they necessarily have to bump it up higher to get a decent option, but to get an option that the people would want, they probably would.
So let's game out some of the scenarios here. Assuming that Chris Mack takes the Wake Forest job, you know, Rick, you mentioned some of the names that have been thrown around. Do we have any idea where this search might start? I mean, would it be fair to say that guys like Kelsey and Steele would get a look?
I mean, I don't think Pat Kelsey's really qualified enough to get this job yet, and he hasn't really done a whole lot at Winthrop just yet to suggest that he's ready for it. But at the same time, with the backing that he already has at Xavier, you could see him at least applying and people pressuring for him to get an interview. The only thing is, again, I think that would be looked at as kind of one of Mike Babinski's guys. I don't know that would be Greg Christopher's first choice. And then, you know, I think Travis Steele is definitely a guy who one could keep Trayvon Blewett, so that would be huge. He's already in place, but I just, again, it comes back to would Greg Christopher and Father Graham be willing to look in house still and look at someone who's already on Chris's staff, or would they want to start completely new? That's just a wild card at this point. We really have no idea what Greg Christopher would do. And then when you look at where he's kind of been, I mean, would he go, like Snow said, would he look to someone that's already in the MAC or an up-and-comer in the MAC, maybe not a Louis Orr, but maybe someone young in the MAC? We really don't know, just because he's kind of new at all this. You know, he doesn't have a big professional circle where you go, oh yeah, he'd probably look at that coaching tree or this guy from where this conference that he used to be a part of.
I do wonder whether or not you could maybe think about the Gene Cady, Matt Painter type.
You might, because he was a Purdue guy would kind of be a guy that might be on that list. But when you look at their staff, it's okay. Who is it? You know?
Yeah.
So I think that would be the most interesting part is if it came down to that, what would be his strategy and where would he start looking? Because maybe Snow has a better idea, but I have absolutely no idea. And I tend to think that if I had to guess, he wouldn't want to look at guys that would be looked at as an already within the staff hire or a Bobinski type guy.
Yeah. I mean, I have no idea what he'd do. What I do think is interesting is when Mike Bobinski did a coaching search, he did it his way and there was complete trust in Mike Bobinski. Now, granted, he had to run it up the flagpole a little bit and, you know, to Kusha and Graham and whoever maybe he had to answer to. But the reality is if Mike Bobinski was doing it, Mike Bobinski was hiring his guy. I'm not thoroughly convinced Greg Christopher has that autonomy, and I'd be very interested to see whose hands firmly in the mix in choosing the next coach, because honestly, there's probably about four people on earth who know all who Mike Bobinski interviewed when Chris got the job. I'm guessing it would be a significantly larger circle this time around.
Well, let me ask you this, Snow. I mean, is there anybody, if you were put in that position, who are the guys that you might consider? I'm kind of throwing you a wild card here, a curveball, but
I will refrain from being the coaching classified ads on that one and just say I have no idea.
All right. So, Rick, the next question is, assuming Chris Mack leaves and assuming Chris Mack does decide to take this job, what happens to the program as it stands right now? I mean, it seems to me from the outside, looking at the roster, looking at what I know about the relationships that this current staff has and the recruits that are coming in and the guys that are already here, that if a new coach came in, it would almost be a Mick Cronin starting from scratch rebuild.
Well, one of the problems you're going to see if that happens is you have two guys that we would think, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about Samaje here in a bit when we talk about the roster. But if you're saying Samaje is back right now, or at least there's a decent chance that he's back, he has an out. He can leave for the draft. And obviously that's weighing on his mind. He's at least considering it. So if Chris Mack takes this job, I think you can definitely see Samaje leaving, unless maybe Travis Steele got the head coaching job. And Justin Martin is another guy who's a fifth year guy, has an out. He could transfer and play right away somewhere else. So those are two guys that could leave right away. And then
Stainbrook as well.
Yeah. That's right.
Oh, yeah. So Stainbrook could do the same thing. And then you have the situation with the big recruiting class that everyone wants to come in. Trayvon Blewett, there's no way if Chris Mack leaves that he would stay. I'm sure he'd end up at Michigan State or somewhere like that. It'd be tough to keep any of those guys, really. I mean, you're talking about three other highly rated guys that would be sought after and people would be interested, especially this late in the game. So I think absolutely it would be a major, major issue. And I'm not saying they couldn't make a good hire that would get it back on track. But when you look at, you know, they are towards the bottom when it comes to pay scale. So it's probably not like they're bringing
Ben Howland.
Right. They're not bringing in some big time established coach already that has some cachet on the recruiting trails. So they are really, really starting from scratch in that rebuild mode. And you're in a tough conference now. I mean, it's not the Big East of old, but it's also not a conference that's going to be easy to get 10 wins in every year. You know, going 500 is never guaranteed in this conference at this point. So it would be a really tough situation, I think, if they were to change coaches right now. And I think when you look at Father Graham, even if he wanted to get rid of Chris Mack at this point, he's in a tough situation because they've had back-to-back low enrollments in the last two freshman classes, and there's no coincidence that those coincided with back-to-back iffy seasons from the basketball program. And he's getting ready to launch a capital campaign. He wants the basketball program to have a really good year next year, like people think they may have. So, I mean, he's not stupid. He gets that part of it. He's in an interesting spot. Chris is in an interesting spot. I think this program is really this is a very interesting offseason for the entire program.
Yeah, this is not the year you want this to be happening, because Justin Martin would, you know, assuming let's get something clear. If Chris were to leave, his assistants are not staying at Xavier. Now, I don't know if they go to Wake Forest with him, or I don't know if they'd pursue other, but they wouldn't stay at Xavier. So you would lose Justin Martin for sure. Samaje wouldn't come back. Trayvon Blewett, no chance. Edmund Sumner, less than no chance. I mean, like, go down the line. O'Mara, no way. You could be looking at a situation where you have six, maybe, scholarship guys next year. Now, that's a worst-case scenario. Odds are it would probably be closer to eight or something like that. But
you're not going to compete. You're not going to compete in the Big East. You're going to be looking at a 2 to 3 year rebuild just to get back to respectability, which is why, to me, this was somewhat smart. If you're Chris Mack and you're trying to get a bump in salary and you're thinking, yeah, you've got a ton of leverage right now, because Travis Steele, you know, I think very highly of him. I know he's thought very highly of in the community, but he's 30 years old. And, you know, Archie Miller got the job at 32, has done a great job, but do you really see X handing over the reins to a guy that's 30 years old? I don't know that I do. And he's maybe the only guy other than Chris that can keep the majority of this team together next year. So to me, it's a no-brainer from a Xavier perspective. If you can pull the money together, you put a package together to keep Chris Mack around, even if it's just for 1 year, because it becomes a lot more difficult for a lot of those guys to jump ship after next year. And hopefully you've got some continuity already established. If you let Chris Mack go at this point, you lose the whole staff, then you have basically given the next guy the Mick Cronin treatment when he took over at UC.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the ideal offseason for this to happen. That said, does anybody on this podcast think Father Graham cares one iota?
I mean, I think he better. I think he should.
I think that's the interesting thing, because you can legitimately see Xavier not really doing a whole lot here. I don't see Xavier really coming out begging and bowing down at Chris's feet saying, no, we need you to stay. We have to have you. Despite the fact that when you kind of look at their situation, they kind of do. I just don't see Father Graham getting to that point where he's going to do that. And if that's what Chris is looking for, and he gets to the point where Wake makes him a better offer, things get really interesting at that point, because I just don't see Xavier saying, we got to do what we got to do to keep him.
No, I don't think there's any chance they do that. I mean, they've never done that, despite what people want to think. You know, like, now granted, could they match what Arizona did? Could they match what Ohio State did for Thad? No. But they, even with Mike Babinski, they never really tried. And anyone who thinks they did is just blatantly wrong. And as I put on the message board, I know one thing, and I think this – I don't know if it bothers Chris, but I'm pretty sure it does, and I know it really bothered Sean, is it's one thing to not make as much as you think you should be making. And – granted, they make a heck of a lot more than I do or I ever will. But when you look over and the coach at Fordham's making $100,000 more than you, you know, you're at least thinking this is kind of ridiculous. But it's one thing for that situation. It's a whole nother thing for this perception to be that you're making significantly more than what you are. And that is one thing that really bothered Sean. Was at the end of the day, Sean's take home was probably in the neighborhood of $750,000. Now, somehow his final year, the number got floated out around there that it was around 1.2. And if you're Sean, you're saying, okay, this is a private university. I know how much I make, and the university knows how much I make. If I'm not telling people it's 1.2, who is? The thing of it is while you're making this, there's this mistrust that's built up. And I know that really bothered Sean, that the university's – in his mind, the university was putting out there that he was making something. In reality, he wasn't.
Yeah. And again, I think there are multiple issues here that do make – this not a slam dunk, but that Chris will stay. But at the same time, at the end of the day, what we started out saying at the beginning of this podcast was ultimately we think he ends up back at Xavier, at least for another year or for however long. Right now, there's just more that Xavier has to offer for him in his career with the team that he potentially has coming back.
Yeah, I think we all agree on that. You put a gun to my head, I'm saying he's back next year. But I would really prefer in this case you didn't put a gun to my head.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't feel all that comfortable.
Exactly right. Dan, I guess one of the next things we were going to talk about is the current roster, the situation, and kind of what's going on with the current team.
Right.
Samaje at this point is kind of the biggest question mark and that everyone's curious about. And at this point, I'd still say 50-50. I think there's still a legitimate chance that he would like to go to the NBA draft. But from what we've heard from most of the feedback, this is another situation where I'd rather you not put a gun to my head. But if you did, I'm going to say Samaje is back at Xavier as well. It sounds like for the most part, it's questionable that he's a second rounder, where he even is in the second round right now. So I just don't see him leaving right now.
First of all, Rick, no, who wants a gun to their head?
Yeah, well,
if you put a gun to my head and asked me where Trayvon Blewett was going to college, I would have felt really comfortable with it. Let me put it that way.
Well, that's funny because some of the message board were less clear. So Rick, getting beyond Samaje, I think we know what his situation is. Brian, do you get a sense of when the timeline? I know that there's a specific deadline date where guys have to declare or not. And my understanding is that they actually have changed it pretty substantially from when we went through this with Derrick Brown or Jordan Crawford, where they used to be able to go to the camps and get an assessment. They could declare, do that, do the assessment, and then pull their name back out. But that's not the case now, is it?
No, basically, and this is the stupidity of the NCAA at its finest. The NCAA has a rule where if you are declared for the draft after, I forget the date, but it's like April 15th, you're not allowed back. You're automatically in the draft. The NBA's rule is you have till April 28th to declare for the draft, and we don't really care. So basically, what it is the NCAA says after April 15th, if you're in school, that means you're in school. And the NCAA says, well, between April 16th and April 28th, they have every opportunity they want to declare for the draft. That said, no, they cannot work out for teams. They can't go to the combine and decide. If they're in on April 27th, they say, I want to go to the draft, they're in for good. There's no way around it.
So we should know within, let's say, 3 weeks of now whether or not Samaje will be back. Rick, moving on to another guy that's been talked about, Justin Martin. Any change in your understanding of his situation? Is it – I mean, obviously, this now we're assuming Chris Mack is back and this all blows over. Any changes in his situation? Is he going to entertain the possibility of transferring out, or is he – pretty definitely going to be back?
I'd be really surprised if he did entertain. I mean, you never rule anything out, especially with a guy like Justin Martin, because he does have the freedom to do so. And he's a player that teams would be interested in, obviously. But with the season that he had and the role that he has coming back to Xavier next year, I just don't see it happening. I think he's a big part of their plans for next year. And with what he did this year, I think he is excited to improve on that. And I know, you know, they're having their meetings this week and he's one of the guys that is definitely they're going to be most optimistic with. And they're saying, look what you did. Now, like Chris Mack said after that NC State game in the post game press conference, Justin needs to take it to the next level. He showed up in some really big games. He relished guarding Doug McDermott and guarding TJ Warren and played really well. Now he needs to go do that against the non-conference schedule and against some of these other teams throughout the year. Instead of doing it every time there's a big game, once every 2 weeks, do it every single night. And he could be a big time player next year. So I think he's definitely back.
Rick, you mentioned these post season meetings that the coaching staff goes through. Can you give some insight into that process? Like is it sort of like a performance review that person who works in an office might receive from HR, or what is sort of the dialogue that that happens. And when we hear about kids being advised at that point to transfer, what's your understanding of how that dialogue takes place?
Well, it's definitely not as formal as that. I mean, obviously they've developed a relationship with these kids. So, you know, they come in and basically it's a time for them to meet and talk about.
Is it with the whole coaching staff or just with Coach Mack?
I think it can be kind of different. I think a lot of times it'll be Coach Mack and someone else, but they meet with the assistants as well. They might meet with a couple coaches. I don't know if Brian has anything else on that.
No, I can't. I think it's just Mack who each kid's assigned, each coach is assigned to like three or four kids or something.
Yeah.
I think it's Jeremy, because Jeremy Groh, the ops guy, because he handles academics. I think it's the coach who's in their group, and I think it's Mack, but it could be the whole staff. Honestly, I've never asked and I don't really know, and it probably varies kid to kid anyway.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think it kind of does vary, but I think obviously, I mean, they talk to all the coaches on the staff. It's not like this is the only time they ever communicate about expectations or review, but it is a little more sit down and, first they evaluate the season, you know, here's what we saw. And it's a time for brutal honesty. It's not, hey, during the season, we're trying to keep your confidence up. It's here's realistically what we saw out of you, what you did right and what you did wrong. And then the expectations for the offseason, you know, you have to do this. You have to drop this amount of weight. You've got to work on this part of your skill set, or you're not going to play here next year. You know, you're not going to get the same minutes you got. There's guys waiting to take your spot. And then you talk about the role going forward. And again, this is where more brutal honesty comes in. And this is a lot of times where probably the part of the transfer comes up. You know, it's, hey, you played X amount of minutes here next year. You're not playing any more than that going forward with the guys we've got coming in, unless something drastically changes. Or it's, hey, you played this amount of minutes this year. You're going to play less next year, unless something drastically changes. And you know, there's some guys this year that are going to have some interesting conversations. I think when you look at, you guys can probably, I think we should all probably jump in on this, but, and maybe talk about who we think it's the most important offseason for. But I think when you look at a guy like Miles Davis, this is a make or break offseason for a guy like him. When you look at the people that are going to be, he played 17.9 minutes a game this past year. That's not going to happen next year. And there's a chance that he barely plays any if he doesn't really reshape his body, get in the gym and become, figure out a way to not go through a slump like he saw, and then improve the rest of his all around game.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I know you were just throwing this situation out, that Miles Davis will not shoot 1-for-22 ever again in his life doing anything. He's never gone through a situation like that, and it'll never happen again.
No, but I think someone who's as good of a shooter as Miles, he's got to rep himself out of that. You know, I think he's got to develop a better work ethic this offseason to get himself in position to where something like that couldn't happen, because he is too good of a shooter for it to ever happen.
Yeah. And I mean, this is where these meetings, like, first of all, they happen with every kid in every program. It's I want everyone to understand it's not a Xavier thing. It's not like, hey, we got 15 guys on scholarship, we need to have these meetings to get down to 13.
Yeah,
no, this is standard operating.
Yeah.
In every sport.
Right. Yeah, every sport everywhere. I mean, it's just what it is. And this is also the meeting where, you know, in Mark Lyon's situation, he was encouraged to leave. He was told, you know, Mark, they put, you know, restrictions on him that they knew he didn't want, that would make him want to leave. So in Mark's mind, he left. In Xavier's mind, they told him to leave. And that's why there's been two sides to that story. The moral of the story is, if Xavier wants someone to come back, for the most part, they'll be able to convince them to come back. If they want someone to leave, while not saying, hey, you have no place here anymore, they can pretty much convince them to leave. And that's what happens in these meetings.
Okay, so this, obviously everyone knows, if Samaje and Justin are back, X needs to clear two scholarships. I think the common thought is that two and perhaps three players could leave as a result. Nothing is official yet. I don't even know. I mean, do you guys think it's appropriate to speculate, or should we just move on to
I'm not throwing Hey, I'm not going to throw any kid's name out. I can say that.
Yeah. I mean, there's no point. But guys, it's like we always say, it's going to work itself out. There's no panic right now. I mean, I think everything inside the program, they know what's going on, and everything will be fine, and it's not going to be a shock to anyone how it works out. So.
As we look at that, though, I mean, there has been talk of potentially a third guy transferring out. There's also the possibility that there are two transfers out and then Samaje decides to leave, or Justin decides that he wants to play somewhere else for his fifth year of eligibility. Or frankly, as Brian mentioned before we started, I mean, even somebody like Matt Stainbrook could leave if he wanted to. I mean, he's eligible to take his fifth year somewhere else. So who, I mean, do you guys get a sense, is X active in the market for transfers? God knows there's been a lot of relatively high profile announcements regarding guys transferring. Indiana, Purdue, West Virginia, a lot of big time schools are losing players this offseason.
Before Snow says a word, I'm going to say this. Don't take any kid from Indiana. They're all nuts.
I don't know what I did to this state when I moved in a few years ago.
You're telling me. Ever since you moved there, it's been a mess.
I don't know what I did, but somehow, like, I'm nuts, and I freely recognize that I'm insane. I made everyone else like me, and it's weird. But yeah, as my world melted down on Monday, as every 15 minutes a new kid from Indiana was transferring, which of course leads to an unbelievable amount of college to my cell phone, where I wanted to put a gun to my head and pull the trigger, irregardless of the answer. Xavier's obviously looking at Ronnie Johnson. That's out there. That, you know, they've got the release. Ronnie's probably going to visit here soon.
And this is the point guard from Purdue, correct?
Yeah, averaged 11-4 at Purdue. They're interested. Now, I'm not a math major, but 15 is more than 13. In order to take Ronnie Johnson, 15 has to become 12. So, you know, if it gets to 12, then Ronnie Johnson becomes an option. But until that point, Xavier's just doing due diligence and really has nothing to offer the kid.
Right. Rick, you have any thoughts? I mean, would X be looking for a transfer of this class, do you think?
Well, for one, I think there's been a lot of announcements, but there are still more that'll happen within the next few weeks as the tournament finishes. And like Snow said, Xavier's not even in position to offer a scholarship to any of these kids yet. So I don't think it's anything serious at this point. And there's never an offseason that's going to go by where they don't look for what's out there in case someone decides to leave or whatever it is. But at this point, I don't see them being too active in the free agent market.
I also want to say that this year and last year a little bit too, this year you definitely have seen more of those fifth year graduate transfers that have gone and made a huge impact at their new school. I know we saw Mark Lyons last year, but you think about the kid from UDM that went to Oregon, Jason Castile.
Kaliste,
I'm sorry. And then also DeAndre Kane at Iowa State, who transferred from Marshall. Two kids that are that really have had a huge impact on teams that went deep into the tournament. So a fifth-year transfer might also be an option as we get into the summertime.
Yeah, no question about it. Could happen.
Yep. Well, one of the other things, Dan, obviously, that was kind of newsworthy this week that came out was the change in exempt events. Originally, they were supposed to be in the Old Spice event that was going to feature Michigan State, Kansas, Georgia Tech, Marquette, Tennessee, among others. But now that's been pushed off to 2015 because Marquette was in there as well, and they couldn't have two teams from the same conference. And now they will be playing in the Wooden Legacy event in Fullerton, California, November 27th, 28th, and 30th this year. That event will feature UTEP, Long Beach State, Princeton, San Diego, San Jose State, Washington, and Western Michigan. What do you say, Snow? You want to make the trip?
No. And I will give no more further than that. I think you wasting my time reading that list of spectacular schools designates a no and a nothing else, and we move on.
Dan, any thoughts? Because I don't care what Snow says.
The only way that this makes – okay, first of all, one of the things that I did when this – when I first got wind of this, which was not a pleasant wind. It was sort of the wind that, you know, my dad makes on Thanksgiving night rather than like a cool summer breeze. But I did look up. I went and I looked up the RPIs and the KenPom ratings of some of these teams.
Better than you'd think, other than San Jose State.
Yes, absolutely. There were a lot of teams that were clustered in that sort of like 90 to 110 range. I know Princeton was there, Western was there, UTEP was there, San Diego, I think, might have been in there.
San Diego is at 131 in KenPom, yeah.
So maybe the argument here is, well, let's say we go out there, we clean house with these three teams. Yeah, there's no marquee win, but as we saw with what Ron Wellman's selection committee did this year, getting those non-conference wins on a neutral site is huge, or away from home is obviously huge. Even if the teams aren't world beaters, if they're sitting, you know, 75 to 125 in the RPI, those still will be theoretically positive. But generally, my response to this is exactly the same as Snow's, which is, you got to be kidding me.
The only thing I'll say is you mentioned that, you know, like 75. UTEP was the second ranked team, according to KenPom, at 96th. And they returned pretty much everyone except for one senior who was a stiff. And they're led by Vince Hunter, a former Xavier recruit who had a big year as a freshman, averaged like 12-8 at the three for them. So I think they have a chance to be decent next year and possibly in that like 70 to 75 range.
Yeah, Washington, that's about it. Know, they have access to a lot of talent in the Pacific Northwest, and they seem to bubble up and bubble back down in the Pac-12 every couple of years. So, I mean, maybe it's not as bad as it looks on paper, but it looks pretty bad on paper.
Yeah. Yeah, I just don't see that inspiring a lot of Xavier faithful to make the trip out either.
Hey, but the good news is that the following year when they go to Old Spice, they might play Dayton again. So maybe we will see that rivalry renewed, albeit in Orlando.
Right.
Yay.
So, I mean, when you look at the non-conference slate as a whole, Rick, at this point, it is pretty dire. You've got Wake Forest away, Alabama at home in the return game from last year. The rest of the sort of big series they've had the last couple of years have dropped off. So really, the only five games that we know are going to happen next year are these three games that I'm guessing that Brian Snow will not be watching from his Indianapolis Palace of Solitude
on ESPN3.
Right. Or Wake Forest or Alabama, both of whom are not very good.
Question.
And so where do you go from here?
If Chris Mack gets the Wake Forest job, do they still play that game?
No.
Probably not. So what's the plan? I mean, we know that we've had Mario on the show a few times. He's an astute guy. He knows what he's doing. I mean, are there fireworks yet to come, or is Xavier just kind of boxed themselves into a point that we're going to see? Here's a bigger question. Is Xavier adopting the old Big East model of playing, of leaving their home state as little as possible before December 31st and feasting on cupcakes until conference play started? Because if so, I'm not real happy with that.
It wouldn't. I mean, I don't think they'll go to the Syracuse model, but, you know,
they're clearly lightening it up.
Yeah, I mean, it ain't going to be, and especially because Wake and Alabama are going to be bad, it ain't going to be good next year.
Yeah, hope you enjoyed that Tennessee game at CentOS this year.
I mean
it ain't going to be good.
Don't you have to find some additional majors here? And I'm not talking about Northwestern here. I'm sorry. I'm talking about legitimate basketball teams that you can play in the non-conference. Because, frankly, you know, you're talking about a season ticket fan base, and we'll get into the UC game in a minute. And I'm, you know, as a season ticket holder, I'm overjoyed at all the Big East home games, although obviously without McDermott, it loses a little bit of its luster next year. But you've taken the UC game out of that possibility. That, you know, the other big rivalry was Dayton. They're never going to play again. So don't you have to bring somebody in, right, to make that season ticket package worthwhile. I mean, people are not going to be happy seeing Kent and Morehead State for 3 weeks. And I think you saw with some of the sparsely attended games this year that people are starting to tune out those bye games in the non-conference.
I'm not saying you're wrong, but I don't know. I don't know that anything's going to be done about it.
Yeah, I mean, you got Alabama. Enjoy it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's I guess I'm kind of struggling with it because on the one hand, you remember when X would bring in, like, you know, Butler when they were in the same league, Purdue, Vandy. You would see all these teams on the non-conference slate, Gonzaga, Memphis, all in the same year. And now, you know, you're looking at a middle bottom of the SEC team, a basement ACC team, and then a lot of uncertainty besides that. And the question is, you know, what's there really to get that excited about? I mean, I'm not complaining about those Big East home games because they're great. It was a lot of fun to go to those 9 games this year, even the DePaul game. But come on. I mean, there's got to be a little bit more before Christmas if you want to keep the building full, if you want to sell those season ticket packages, because a lot of people will just elect not to purchase season tickets and to buy a 4-game pack or buy a 6-game pack during Big East time. So anyway, moving beyond that, let's talk about the UC situation. I mean, is this game going to happen this year?
That's the good news. I still think that game's happening. Snow's going to tell me I'm an idiot and I'm wrong, but I'm just going to say it's going to happen.
Find a way for me. You tell me how it's happening.
Snow, I don't have all the answers. I'm just telling you what I've been told, and I still think it's going to happen.
I mean, that's fine, but everyone I talk to say it's going to happen, but then I ask how. And it's crickets.
Well, the part of it in this, and I don't know how to piece this all together because I don't have all the information. I don't know what all is going on. But I do know that there has been a lot of movement with UC and the city and everyone trying to upgrade US Bank Arena, give it a facelift, and potentially move UC games down there in the future. Also try to get the Republican National Convention or whatever that deal is down there as well. So I think that probably has a role in this somewhere. I just don't know exactly where it is because, you know, you've got people talking about, well, Xavier's caving in and playing at US Bank Arena this year. So, I mean, I could see them maybe agreeing to it's UC's turn to host this year. Well, or dress the facilities this year. If you go off of that. So I could at least see a 1-year agreement for now saying, okay, we'll agree to go back there with the idea that we're working something out.
First on campus game would be at Cintas. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
I'm not saying that's how it's working out, but I do think there's possibilities of concessions on either side with what's going on with US Bank Arena and some of the movement there.
But none of that's conceded by December.
Yeah, you might be right, but
and let alone when the schedule gets set 2 months from now.
We'll see. I continue to say it'll happen. Snow says no. I don't know where. You guys can decide for yourself where you stand.
So the bargaining positions of the two sides are Xavier wants on campus, and they don't really care where UC plays their home games. If they want to play their home games at US Bank Arena, more power to them. And UC's position is neutral site from here on out. And I understand what Snow is saying because I agree with you, Brian. I don't think there is a middle ground here.
But if UC is moving to US Bank Arena,
bit of give and take.
But if UC is moving to US Bank Arena and it becomes their home facility, then you're moving it back to home court arenas. You can't say we're having a neutral site at US Bank Arena if it's our home court anymore.
Oh, I bet they probably would try.
and even then, that's not happening next year.
No, you're right. I mean, that's still years away, but that's the only way I'm seeing maybe concessions there. I don't know why people are optimistic that'll happen, but I continue to hear that it's going to happen.
I keep hearing it too, and I keep asking how, and no one has any sort of answer, not even like a hint. Oh, it'll get done. Okay, cool. Good talk. See you out there.
Who from you guys' perspective should cave?
Neither side.
So you're fine with the game going away?
I wish both sides could act like rational human beings, but that hasn't happened in 25 years. What's gonna make it start now?
I guess the thing I'm
okay with the game going away.
Yeah. But
why should Xavier cave to UC? No good reason. Why should UC cave to Xavier? No good reason.
I guess I don't understand why UC. To me. And this will be no surprise given my background, but I think UC's position is completely untenable here. The game was played at campus sites forever, effectively. And the point of moving downtown was because of a fear of security issues, or maybe there's a financial. It hasn't worked financially, and there's been no issues the last 2 years. So what's the basis for not moving it back to the campus? Or is how they'll have it the third next year. They get the home game first. So I don't understand why their position is as intractable as it is. And maybe the answer is that they just need to play it at a neutral site and hopefully Mick Cronin takes another job after next year and we can get back to normal.
Well, I mean, I think there's a decent chance of that happening. So
whether you think it's logical or not, the reality is – it's what they think.
You're not wrong about that.
You know, it's like you don't have to agree with someone's position, but if it's their position, it is their position. As illogical or logical as it may be, it's what it is. And that's what theirs is. Just like I'm sure if I went on a UC side, I could come up with very, well, not somewhat logical reasons why they don't want to play Cintas again.
Yeah, because they might lose. I mean, that's what it boils down to. Now, I do want to say that I fully do not believe that X particularly can claim the moral high ground here when their reason for not going to UD Arena is virtually identical to UC's reasons for not wanting to come to CentOS. So I although with Chris Mack, I mean, maybe there's some personal issues there that do have a little bit more validity for me. But yeah, let's not get too high and mighty. As those of us that are Xavier fans, when we consider the destiny of our other chief rival.
Yeah, I mean, there's no moral high ground to be had here on either side. And once again, no side needs it more than the other. Anyone making this argument needs to stop.
Yeah, both sides are just taking their ball and going home.
Rick, can you put that in the same box as my comment about how anybody talking about the RPI has already proven they don't know what they're talking about?
Yeah, no problem. Consider it done.
Okay. All right, so I think the next topic we were going to hit, guys, was just to talk about the NCAA tournament. At this point, thoughts, you know, best games, best players, things you're looking forward to, who you think's going to win. Brian, we'll start with you. Any particular observations you've had from this first weekend?
You know, it's kind of what I thought. You know, there's not a great difference between teams. You know, Wichita State's really good. Are they one of the top four teams? I don't know. Kentucky's pretty good. Are they one of the top 20 teams? I don't know. They're about even. You look, you know, Harvard beat UC, and we discussed this earlier. We thought that was a terrible matchup for Harvard. You know, like, just there's just not much of a difference this year between squads, and it all comes down to how you match up with them, and quite honestly, if you can make shots. So I'm not surprised. I thought the Kentucky-Wichita State game was tremendous.
Yeah, it was awesome.
I'm not sure it was the best game of the
second
weekend.
Second best game of the tournament, behind Iowa State, North Carolina.
For me, I'm saying that game was tremendous, but it was the only game going on at that time. So that's why people remember it more than North Carolina Providence, North Carolina Iowa State, NC State, St. Louis. The list goes on and on.
I want to throw one in too that I thought was tremendous was Wisconsin Oregon.
Yeah, that was a fun. You know what game was fun to watch though? I thought Dayton Ohio State was exciting. I enjoyed the hell out of the second half.
Yeah, it was ugly, but yeah, it was.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Very exciting.
I don't know if fun to watch is the term I would use, but interesting.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the second half of that.
Both of Dayton's games were very interesting to watch and were exciting, if not well played. I thought.
I think. First half. After the Dayton Syracuse game almost killed me.
That was bad. I tuned in at halftime. I'm sorry. So I'll ignore that. Ignore that comment from me.
To go back to what Brian was saying though, I agree with him. The line continues to be blurred between high majors, low majors, the haves not. I mean, we don't need fluke performances for upsets anymore. Duke doesn't have to go out and lay a complete egg. They can shoot the ball pretty well from the outside and lose to Mercer because Mercer legitimately had advantages inside and in other spots. We're getting to the point where so many kids come up playing basketball from the time they're 5 years old and playing in high level AAU, and we scour the country for every single kid that can play. So coaches have an idea. We're getting to the point where the line is blurred legitimately. And I mean, granted, the cream of the crop, the blue bloods still end up rising to the top, but these upsets become less and less of a surprise, and you don't need something crazy for them to happen. And it's only going to continue to get more. We'll see more parity in the tournament.
I mentioned that I thought that Oregon Wisconsin may have been one of my favorite games of the weekend, but Brian also brought up Providence UNC, which I thought was tremendous, and Bryce Cotton went out like an absolute monster, as he has, you know,
as George Crawford would say, he went out like a G.
Exactly. Exactly. And I agree with you, Rick. I mean, I don't think there's a whole lot of separation. And I think what's interesting is seeing how, because there isn't, it's almost like the NFL, where like one blown coverage decides a game.
Yeah.
Or one mishandled snap decides a game. You think about, you know, one stupid decision by who was it? I don't think it was LaQuentin Ross, but whoever fouled Dyshon Pierre on that three-pointer at the end of the Ohio State
Shannon
Dayton
Scott,
game.
That's family.
Shannon Scott. I mean, that was a huge moment in that game. You think about the kid from VCU that fouled the three-point shooter in their loss to Stephen F. Austin. And then, you know, also matchups just have been such a thing. I mean, Baylor is basically a team that is genetically engineered to stop Creighton. Yeah. I mean, everything that Creighton wants to do, everything that they tried to do in that game was completely neutralized by Baylor's length and their speed. Now, can Baylor do that to other teams they're going to play later in this tournament? I doubt it. But for that one game, they absolutely boat raced them. So, I mean, a lot of the things that we know are true about the tournament continue to be true, but I think that you're right. I think that the parity, there's just not that big of a difference anymore. You look at Eastern Kentucky leading Kansas, you know, well into the second half. This kind of stuff happened in the past, but it didn't happen as frequently, I don't feel like. Or you think about, you know, St. Louis needing a miracle to beat NC State, who came out of the first four, and Tennessee just absolutely crushing people to get to the Sweet 16. I mean, there's just really not a huge difference between those teams, and it makes for an exciting tournament. But I do think that this week you're going to see, you know, normal service restored to a certain extent with the Blue Bloods reclaiming their birthright.
Dan, can I guess your favorite player in the tournament?
It might be Sam Decker at this point.
I was going to guess Frank Kaminsky.
Well, yes, it's sort of. He's not enough of a stiff, though.
Yeah, I just figured a 7-footer that.
And Sam Decker's not a stiff, by the way.
He's really athletic.
Enjoy him, but okay, guys, I want to ask a couple things. First of all, who wins a Kentucky Louisville game?
Kentucky. I've got Kentucky in the Final Four. Well, we got to do Final Four, right?
Yeah.
Are we doing Final Four now, or what? Our practice.
I've got Kentucky winning that game. I've got Kentucky in my Final Four, along with Florida, Michigan State, and Arizona.
Florida, Michigan State, Arizona, Kentucky. Okay.
I have Michigan State, Arizona, Florida, and then in my bracket it says Duke, but now I'd go with Michigan.
Okay. I'm going to take Florida out of the South, although I think that Dayton will beat Stanford and Florida will beat Dayton in the regional final. In the East – yeah, I'm with you guys. I think it's Michigan State. I'd say Michigan State over Iowa State in the Elite Eight. The West, man, I'm tempted to take Wisconsin over Arizona. That'll be an interesting regional final, but I would tend to go with you guys. And then I got Louisville winning the Midwest. I don't know why. I can't particularly defend it given the way Kentucky played in the Wichita State game, but I think that they'll pull it together and they'll go back to the Final Four.
Well, I just look at one thing that you have to do to beat Kentucky right now, if they continue to play the way they have been, is keep them off the offensive glass. And while Louisville's a good offensive rebounding team themselves, especially when Montrezl Harrell's playing well, they're not good on the defensive end. They give up a lot of second chance points. And if you allow Kentucky to do that consistently throughout the game, they're just impossible to stop. It gives them too much confidence. They get rolling if you allow them to score like that off of second chance buckets.
The one thing I will say is the Harrisons don't like when guards can get underneath and pressure them, and Louisville can do that, but I agree. I think Kentucky wins that game. And then through no logic, I'm guessing Michigan over Kentucky.
Snow, on Friday night in Indianapolis, will you be putting up just plywood over all the windows in your house when all the people from Kentucky show up, and maybe just like, I don't know. I know you're probably going to the game, but if I was you, I'd probably just head for like Northern Michigan or something like that for the weekend.
See, Dan, here's the dilemma. Like, I hate people. So going to games can really be problematic because I have to sit in the stands.
Oh, God.
And that doesn't usually end well. So I don't know if I'm going to go, but you know, I am kind of worried that Rick's Latonians are going to be out in force in my city. That is a concern.
First of all, for the Xavier fans that followed Xavier to the Sweet 16 in Atlanta when they played Baylor a couple years ago, if you hung around in Atlanta that weekend, you'll know that Catlanta and the Big Blue Nation is actually very fun to be around when their team is in town. Much like the Creighton fans were in New York City, I might add, Dan, except there's just more of them. And
there's more mustaches and dodgy mullets, probably, too.
And second of all, Snow, if you were smart, you would charge about $65 for parking in your front yard, because that's pretty much what every parking spot in the entire city will probably be taken up by people with giant trucks.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
You're an entrepreneur, Rick Torrey.
Always trying to make a buck.
I also wanted to bring this up. This will compound the misery of the people who are listening to this. But, I mean, is there any – what was your assessment of Dayton and the run they went on to get to the Sweet 16? Obviously, they won two very close games, but they beat two blue bloods in doing so. And for me, the thing that stuck out as I watched the Flyers play those two games is – they don't seem to have had too many complete recruiting whiffs over the last few years. It seems like they have a lot of guys that contribute to that team, even if they're just role players. And I'm wondering if obviously Jordan Seibert, you know, getting him was a huge coup, but I'm wondering if that's sort of the weakness that X has had. Maybe I'm completely off base, but it seems like during the Mac period, X has either been, you know, hit a home run. It's been an Adam Dunn recruiting cycle, I guess. You either hit a home run or you strike out. It doesn't seem like they've been able to develop the role players that a Dayton has over the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, you guys can tell me I'm completely wrong, but that was the impression I got. Do you agree with that, or am I completely off base?
I think you're a little bit off.
How so?
I just think
I thought he was just going to leave it.
I think Arch is he's because their best players aren't as good as Xavier's best players. He's more willing to put his second unit in because there's less of a drop off. If you look at Brandon Randolph against good teams at the beginning, when he was playing minutes, he was playing well. As his minutes tapered off and he didn't get that regular rotation, his play fell off because he wasn't getting those minutes. So I do think. If you're Xavier and you're putting Brandon Randolph in, you're taking out Samaje or D. If you're Dayton, you're taking out Kyrie Price.
Yeah, and that's the thing I was going to say. I think there's just less separation on their team, so there are more guys who are going to contribute. But I do think when you look at like a Devin Scott, who was a guy who tried to commit to UC, committed to one of their assistants, and then Mick, after he publicly announced it on Twitter, Mick was like, "What are you doing? We're not taking his commitment." And he ends up at Dayton. Would have been a guy that would have helped UC. He's better than running out David Narsuk. You know, I mean, he's been a serviceable big guy in the post for them. I think you have a point to an extent, Dan, that they have found some solid players. They're to the point where they have experience. You know, a guy like Jordan Seibert has at least been a part of big time winning basketball, even in the tournament already throughout his career. He's seen it, even though he hasn't participated necessarily. So,
and B. Sanford sat on the bench watching Georgetown lose two terrible first round games. So,
right.
I mean, he's at least been there, I guess.
I do think that stuff helps, though. Just having experienced guys, I think there is something to be said for that. But, you know, I'm with Snow to an extent. I think there's less of a drop off between their bench and Xavier's bench when it comes to how many guys are, quote unquote, contributing.
All right. Potpourri round. Snow, whatever you want to talk about.
All right. I need to talk about my favorite subject, Andy Dalton.
Fire away.
Your good friend and mine, Paul Dougherty, wrote an absolutely asinine column about Andy Dalton should wait and not take the money because he's in a position of leverage. While that may make sense, let's give Mike Brown a little bit of credit for having a brain. While he keeps saying how good Andy Dalton is in public, and Marvin does as well, they're not dumb. Even if he wins the Super Bowl this year, they're not going to give him elite quarterback money. And there's a reason why. He's not an elite quarterback. So it comes down to, does Andy Dalton think he can have an elite quarterback moment this year, which is something he's never done before, and get Joe Flacco money from somebody else? Or does he risk not having another status quo year where he ends up with Alex Smith money, where the Bengals would offer halfway in between?
Hold on. Is Joe Flacco elite? Are you coming down on one side of that? Or
his money's elite.
Well, here's that's my thing. I disagree with you to an extent. I agree with a lot of what you say, but that is where I disagree. If Andy Dalton were to take this team next year deep into the playoffs, and especially if he somehow won a Super Bowl, you would be paying him Joe Flacco money. No way around it. You would
I don't think Mike Brown would.
You would have to.
I would agree with him in not doing it, but I do not think he would.
No, you would tag him for 1 year. I mean, and you would draft somebody to take over.
You know what a franchise tag is on a quarterback? You can't afford to.
A Brazilian dollars, but I think
they have to do it for
Mike
a year.
Tyson would say. But
this but is why my original position on this whole thing, when it came up months ago, and I guess it just came back up because the Bengals made a statement that they really want to get it done or something, but that's what they've said all along. So I agree with Snow. The Bengals aren't stupid. They don't think Andy Dalton deserves elite money. So if they're offering him this contract now, this extension now, I can't imagine there's any chance that it's for elite type money, which if Andy Dalton takes that and takes a discounted rate, I think he's an idiot. I think his agent would be an idiot.
I just want to throw into the mix that there was an article on MMQB, Peter King's site today, that was like a great hot sports take that I just enjoyed to no end. The headline of it is by a guy named Greg Bedard.
He's good. I like him.
The article is, the Bengals are crazy for thinking Andy Dalton is their QB of the future. And I just want to read one sentence that just stuck out to me that I just thought was completely amazing. The Bengals, okay, and this is a quote. The Bengals want to make sure their prized flower, who is wilted when the pressure has been at its highest, continues to grow inside the coddled existence they've carved out for him. Dalton's always been the starter and never had to worry about competition. Now, after Lewis's comments, having to worry about a contract would bring too much stress to a player who plays a position where impervious to pressure is as vital as breathing. That's a hot sports take where I come from, especially the part about being sort of a hothouse flower or whatever it was. But you know what? I can't disagree with it at the end of the day. I mean, I personally think the Bengals need to start coming up with an exit strategy for Andy Dalton, because I'm not sure that he's ever going to take that next step.
I don't disagree with you guys, but here's the problem. What's your solution? Because you have a window right now where you've got a pretty good team built. There's no guarantee, especially in the NFL and especially with who's running the Bengals franchise, that lasts more than the next 3, maybe 4 years with the defense that you've built and some of these other skill positions that you're going to have to re-sign over the next several years. So unless you think you can bring in someone who's going to be as good as Andy Dalton right now, which in this draft and where they're drafting, I don't think they feel that way. What are you really going to do? You're going to bring in a guy the next year and start all over then. I just don't see them starting over if Andy Dalton can get it done. That's why, again, if you can sign him for a discounted rate now, I'm all for it. But I don't think the Bengals will pay him any type of legit money this year for an extension. So if Andy Dalton takes that contract, I think he's an idiot, or his agent's an idiot, I should say. And but the problem from the Bengals standpoint is, if he does lead them deep into the postseason next year, he's going to cost way too much to re-sign for a guy who's not a
winner. I just think the Bengals are offering him good money now, I think, is kind of the deal, which would actually be an overpay relative to what he is.
But I'd be fine with that right now. If you can get him for that now, the problem is, if he does well next year, you can't get him for quote unquote good money. You're going to be paying him like an elite starting quarterback.
But he's going to get Cam Newton money again. If he Daltons again, can he even get what he gets offered this year? Because he's another year older and another year more proven of what he is.
He might not, but he's a starting quarterback in the NFL. This
5 days before opening day.
Well, you want to talk about the walking infirmary across the street down there, or what?
I mean, jeez.
They've only got 4 roster players available right now.
Legitimately, I don't know how they're going to fill out a 25 man.
I mean, Roger Bernardina is going to be this year's
right. Oh, God, who is that? Huh? Right. Who is that? That's our point. We have nothing to say about that team right now because I don't know who they're putting on the field.
Well, I mean, they haven't lost any of their starting position players yet, have they?
They lost Skip Schumacher.
That's true, and the fact that that is a legitimate problem makes my heart hurt. That we're in a position where we're relying on Skip Schumacher, but I will be there. It's supposed to be 70 degrees. I mean, that's what I'm sort of banking on, I guess.
Well, that was a great hot sports take. Glad we switched over for that.
Well, I mean, you're talking about Andy Dalton. I mean, Andy Dalton is what he is. It's just a matter of how much money the Bengals are going to waste flushing down that particular rat hole before they realize that the guy can't win in the clutch. That's a hot sports take.
Okay, but what's the solution then? Just draft another guy right now and go to him?
No, Zach Mettenberger sounds pretty good to me.
All right. Well, I hope they can get him.
Okay. It seems like we're at loggerheads at this point. So, gentlemen, just to sum up.
Wait a minute. What word did you just use?
Loggerheads.
Is that like the guy who projectile vomited green beer on you when we were walking in New York?
That was
pretty, he a loggerhead?
That was pretty incredible. and I would like to say that I reacted to it like what's the movie? Keanu Reeves in The Matrix. But actually, it just sort of went right in front of me, and I sort of watched it go, and was like, man, I'm glad I wasn't a step forward of where I was.
Actually, you stopped dead in your tracks, made the most ridiculous fart face ever, looked down at your right sleeve to make sure there weren't any green chunks on you, and then just nodded your head slowly. And then continued walking. It was awesome.
There was no other proper response at that point.
There wasn't. The dude goes, oh, sorry, man.
Yeah. This is what you get for going drinking and around NYU 2 days before St. Patrick's Day, I guess. But good Lord.
All right. Well, that does it for the Scott Williamson edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, only available on MusketeerReport.com. For Dan and the legend Brian Snow, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.